Some exposure, dark sizes where you take a longer exposure and print it a little bit longer and make it look brighter. You have to do that because there is such a tremendous range of brightness among the four satellites. But the problem with that is you get the impression that, for example, the bright areas and the dark areas on Ganymede are the same relative brightnesses, the same grayscale values as the bright areas and dark areas on, for example, the Earth's moon. There is absolutely nothing comparable. The darkest area you can find in the whole of Ganymede is far brighter than the brightest area on the Earth's moon. And so, also, there's much less contrast on Europa than there is on any of the other three. And so there's Io, there's Europa, there's Ganymede, and there's Callisto. These prints have been adjusted so that they are to the right relative sizes. Ganymede and Callisto reach about 3,000 miles across the size of Mercury. Io and Europa reach about 2,000 miles across the size of the Earth's moon. And they have been adjusted so that they are the right relative brightnesses and contrast. Now, the other thing you notice is this. We had only the distant pictures of Callisto a few days out, you know, before Voyager 1 got there. We saw these bright dots all over and we said, maybe those are impact craters. And I was right, they were. For Ganymede, we saw bright dots all over and we said, maybe those are impact craters. And they were. For Io, we saw bright dots, dark dots all over and we said, maybe those were impact craters. And they weren't. They're volcanoes. But at least they were dots. On Europa, you didn't see any dots. And so the suspicion after Voyager 1 was that Europa had a very, very much younger surface than Ganymede or Callisto. Callisto has the oldest surface. It's unchanged from the origin of the solar system. Ganymede has the second youngest surface. Much of it is, some of it is unchanged since the origin of the solar system, but much of it is not. It's a little bit younger. Io has by far the youngest surface, but we'll get to Io. Europa could very well have had a surface that was very young because there didn't seem to be any obvious craters. Of course, from a distance, you couldn't be sure of that. Maybe, for example, the reason you don't see any craters there is that although they're there, they're the same brightness as the surrounding ice. You know, ice looks like ice, and so you don't see any contrast. And from that distance, all you can see is features that show contrast. Well, in fact, Europa turns out to have a virtually crater-free surface. There is Europa, an absolutely incredible picture from Voyager 2. And you can see maybe one feature which might be an impact crater. There are, in fact, two undoubted impact craters on the surface of Europa, and from that you can deduce that the age of that surface is roughly half a billion years, half of 1 billion years. Now, please understand, there's something that always gets people confused when I get to about this point, and that is I'm saying that Io has a much younger surface than Europa, which has a younger surface than Ganymede, which has a younger surface than Callisto, and people think they go home and think they've heard me say Io was formed more recently than Europa, and Europa was formed more recently than Ganymede, and so on. No, 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 no. They are all the same age. The bodies are all the same age, we think, and that is 4.6 billion years. We think that everything in the solar system, all the planets, all the moons, the sun, everything is 4.6 billion years old. But the surface of some planets are constantly being destroyed and rebuilt. For example, an average age for the surface of the Earth, for an area on the surface of the Earth, is a few hundred million years. We consider the Appalachian Mountains, which are 1/4 of 1 billion years old, to be relatively old mountains. There are a few areas on the surface of the Earth which are considerably older than that, but most of them are fairly young. And the reason for that is the age of the surface is the length of time since whatever it was that produced the present-day surface that we see now happened. It does not mean that there wasn't a surface there before that, but that surface was destroyed and the present-day surface was created a certain number of years ago, and that's what we mean by the age of the surface. Okay, first thing you notice is that same eerie smoothness of the horizon. But in this case, when you look at the pictures taken near the shadow edge, near the terminator, where you would be able to see any ridges or valleys if they existed, you see virtually nothing. Europa is by far the flattest, the smoothest world that has ever been seen. The highest mountains on Europa are low ice ridges. These bright things turn out to be ridges. And they are at most a few hundred feet high. There are no valleys whatsoever. So it has this unbelievable two-dimensionality of the surface, and the reason is very simple. On Ganymede and Callisto, you had a surface that, yes, had a lot of ice in it, but it had some rock, too, therefore some strength. On Europa, it is totally ice, and ice flows. Ice is not a strong material. Nevertheless, ice can produce hills, glaciers, that are as much as a mile high, And this ice, and that's even on Earth, this ice is a good deal stronger than the ice that we have on Earth because it is very, very much colder, being so much farther from the sun. And so what we're saying is probably relatively soon, below that, relatively close to that surface, there is a place where the water either is now or once was liquid. Now, what are all the lines? They are not grooves. They are not cracks. They may look it, but they're not. They're absolutely flat. There is no depression in those lines. The bright streaks are ridges, but the dark things are not depressions. They're not cracks the way they look. But they certainly look like cracks. So you can imagine that once upon a time, oh, two more things I should fill in. Number one, there is absolutely no evidence of volcanic action on Europa, or else those lines would be buried. Okay? At least here and there, they would be buried by the volcanic material. And number two, there is absolutely no evidence that there has been fault motion along those lines. In other words, that one side of the line has moved relative to the other. I don't know if everybody knows the word fault in geology does not simply mean a crack in the ground. It means a crack in the ground along which there has been relative motion, either in the horizontal direction or in the vertical direction or both. If you simply have a crack and there's been no relative motion, you don't call it a fault. There is another term for it, you call it a joint, but the point is it's not a fault. And so when you talk about fault, you're talking about motion, and I think you can see by simply looking at any of the places where two lines intersect that there has been no fault motion anywhere on the surface of that planet. So what we are seeing, if those are in fact former cracks, is a case where the entire globe expanded once. And you can imagine that that happened because for some reason down there under the surface it got a little bit warmer and some of the water melted and expanded and forced the surface above it to crack, and then some of that liquid water, perhaps burying some dirt from the rock that is not terribly far below the ice, came up into the crack and filled them in. And so you have all these dirty cracks, which is a possibility for the reason they appear dark. Yeah? You got a point there. Okay, other way around, it froze. I'm sorry, you're absolutely right. I have absolutely no excuse for saying that except I've been thinking about Saturn for the last month. You're absolutely right. The point is, though, if you have a temperature change, okay, and so, it's got to get colder instead of warmer, therefore the ice will expand, okay, if you have a global expansion. Or, if you like, the rock underneath expanded, perhaps because something melted down inside the rock. You know, whatever. You've got to have some sort of global expansion, and what I'm trying to say is that thermal changes will do it for you. And then, since the ice had, the water had made its way up into the crack and frozen, when the heat or the cold or whatever it was went away again, the planet couldn't simply contract back down to the size that it had been before. The crack couldn't simply close up because there was something filling them in. And so the surface humped up and formed these ice ridges, which do appear to be younger in all cases than the dark material. So there is a suggested scenario for the geologic history of Europa. And when all this happened, of course, is very hard to say, but it seems to have been recent enough that the age of the surface is fairly young. It's younger than most of the crater bombardment period. A major question has got to be, what is it that erases craters from this surface and yet does not disturb this intricate filigree network of dark lines and bright ice ridges? Yeah? There is tidal, okay. Well, you know what that means, most of the people don't. Very briefly, the tidal forces depend on a whole lot of different factors, one of which is, I can't explain that yet. The answer is tidal forces are negligible in Ganymede and Callisto. You get about one-tenth as much tidal heating inside Europa as you do inside Io, and as you see, that is enough to produce some geologic activity, and in Io, they go to town, okay? But I can't explain about that until I've explained the tidal forces. Here is a magnificent Voyager 1 picture of Jupiter with its two innermost moons, Io and Europa. You can see that although they are the same size, they are very, very different from each other in a lot of other respects, one of which is that Io is by far the reddest object known in the solar system of any size. It's even redder than Mars. The only thing we know that's even redder than Io is the little bitty moon, Amalthea. And the other thing that you can see is that Europa is very, very bright. In fact, in this picture, it's overexposed. Of course, this picture shows all three bodies. So it could not be taken at the optimum exposure for all of them. It was taken at the optimum exposure for Jupiter, which turns out not to be all that bad for Io, but again, you get an idea here of what the contrast is like. The next one is one that you will be absolutely stunned by if you haven't seen it, but if you've been doing any reading in the astronomy journals for that very reason, you have. This is one of the two great classic pictures from Voyager 1, and it shows Io and Europa silhouetted against the surface of Jupiter, each of them happening to be over a feature of its own color so that you can compare them with Jupiter. And there it is. And please remember, Jupiter is a 250,000 miles behind the two moons in that picture. Gives you some idea of the enormous size that Jupiter has. Io over the great red spot and Europa over one of the bright stripes. And the reason you can see each one is that there's a shadow there. Yeah? Oh, that's a good question. Io is the easiest one for me to answer because Io is the same size as the Earth's moon, and it's about the same distance from Jupiter as our moon is, and so it seems from Jupiter, which is not the question you asked, it would look the same size in the sky as our moon does from the Earth. Okay? Now, as seen from Io, Jupiter is 40 times the diameter of our moon in the sky as seen from Earth, so about 20 degrees. That's big. That would be impressive. And it seems from Europa, Europa is maybe 50% again farther than Io, so call it 12, 15 degrees, something like that. Oh, you're not getting very much compression with the storage. This picture was taken from several million miles away. Those are pretty good relative sizes. Okay, let's talk about Io. Another picture of it, silhouetted against the surface of Jupiter from a quarter of a million miles behind Io. And you see all these dark spots. And those were discovered, about a day out. And it was suspected they might be impact craters. And as Larry Soderblom put it, Io had craters for about 20 hours. As we came further and further in, it became more and more obvious that they were not craters. That they're not circular, they don't have, they're not surrounded by rings of radiation material and so forth, and in fact, that there were no impact craters visible. And so the age of Io's surface began to go down. When you can see there are no craters of 50-mile diameters, then the age has to be less than, say, 250,000,000 years. When you can see there are no craters of 10 miles in diameter, then the surface has to be, say, 10 million years old and so forth. And finally, the very, very closest pictures of Io, which could have shown craters as small as a quarter mile across, that is smaller than Meteor Crater in Arizona, still, on the entire surface of that moon, there is not one single crater visible. And what that means is the staggering fact that Io is by far the most geologically active body in the entire solar system. Every bit of its surface is totally destroyed and totally remade every million years or less. That is 1/40 of 1% of the age of Io. It is literally true that if you painted your name on the surface of Io this year, it would not be visible this time next year. The surface is being remade at that kind of rate. Well, of course, one of the big arguments for exploring other planets and moons is to understand our own planet better. And one of the problems with that has always been that every other body we had ever seen was less geologically active than the Earth. Now, for the first time, we have one that is so active that it makes the Earth look dead. And so we have the whole spectrum now, for the first time, with the Earth within it. How could Io possibly be so active? The irony of it was that since it is the only one of the Jovian of the Galilean satellites that is essentially the size of our own moon, and since we knew that it's the only one that's made of rock, we knew what the moons were made of ever since Pioneer 10, because Pioneer 10 got density measurements as it flew past them. And so, you know, it was made of rock like our moon, it's the size of our moon, so we figured it was going to be like our moon. And in fact, the geologists on the imaging team were figuring it would be totally covered by craters, and they were going to use the crater density on its surface as the calibration to understand the others, which were going to look less like the moon. Instead, I think you've seen this remarkable paradox, that as you move in through the four Galilean satellites, and get to bodies that on the inside are steadily more and more like our moon. Until by the time you get to Io, it is so moon-like that not only is it made of rock, but there is no water at all. And there is no water at all in our moon. We do not understand why. But Io is like that also. And yet, as you move in that sequence, the surfaces, in regard to their appearance, in regard to their relative importance of endogenic versus exogenic features, in regard to the youth of their ages, get steadily less and less like our moon until, just as Callisto, the outermost, had a surface that is more like our moon than the moon is, Io is more like the Earth than the Earth is, in the sense of being totally dominated by endogenic features, just as Callisto is totally dominated by exogenic features. Truly remarkable. The black and white pictures were incredible enough. It was when we got the color pictures that people really began to scream. That is a true color picture of Io. The colors, as with all of these Voyager images, are very slightly exaggerated, but hardly at all. That is actually what that thing looks like. I think if any science fiction artist a year ago had painted that and tried to sell it to an editor, he would have been told, don't be ridiculous, there couldn't possibly be a world that is that garish. Go tone it down. In fact, Larry Soderblom, when he showed this picture, quite seriously said, I couldn't understand why everybody started to laugh for a second, I guess, quite seriously said, we're working on a color suppression routine for the computers. And what he meant was, the colors are so garish and the contrasts are so strong, that it's very, very hard to see shadows. It's very hard to see topography. And they were working for something that would bring out the topography in specialized versions of the pictures at the expense of the color. But there it is. Just as with Ganymede, there was this big debate in the press room as to whether the grooves were snowmobile tracks or dune buggy tracks. So in the press room for Io, there was this big argument as to whether it is best described as looking like a pizza or looking like some sort of citrus fruit. My favorite description of Io was penned by George Alexander, the science reporter for the Los Angeles Times, who came up with, rather like an orange that had been savagely attacked with an ice pick. And that's very much the way it looks. Now, one thing we did know about Io before we got there, and that is that the spectrum of its surface did not show rock, it did not show ice. What it showed was salt and sulfur. And the suspicion now is that, in fact, all of these colors can be explained by sulfur in various crystal forms. And we've gone through this before. And, in fact, these dark things are volcanoes. Most of them are dead, inactive. But, for example, take a look at this one, which you will notice is surrounded by a suspicious ring of bright material. Because of the coloration there, it may look as though that is a raised ring. It is not. That is painted on the surface. Those are what we call albedo features. In other words, features that are made visible by their contrast, light and dark, or different color or whatever, as opposed to topographic features, which are features that are high versus low. You don't see much topography in the equatorial regions of Io. You see lots of topography, miles in height, so unlike the other Galilean satellites, in the polar regions where you have these peculiar mountains that look as though they are the edges of plateaus that have been eaten into somehow, that have been eroded by something. And we're not at all clear on what that something is. So there is by far the most garish appearing moon or planet in the solar system, as photographed by Voyager 1, and the most startling discoveries are yet to come. There is a picture that was taken of Io on the way out by Voyager 1. It shows a crescent Io, and you can see the dark side, what should be the dark side as far as the sun is concerned. The sun is over there somewhere, right? You can see it lighted up by Jupiter light. Jupiter shining onto Io, and as I just mentioned, Jupiter appears 40 times as big in diameter in Io's sky as the moon does, the full moon does, as seen from Earth, and furthermore, Jupiter is an awful lot more reflective. So it lights up the dark side of Io very nicely. This, probably the greatest discovery by Voyager 1, or Voyager 2 for that matter, was made by accident by Linda Mora Bigo, who was a technician on the optical navigation team. What they do is take pictures from a distance of moons and planets that they fly past with long enough exposure to show stars in the background. Those are not stars in the background, those are defects in my picture, but nevertheless, they're visible in the original picture. The exact location, the exact directions of the stars in the universe are very well known from astronomical measurements, and so you can tell the exact direction the camera was pointed, and believe it or not, it is even more accurate to keep track of the spacecraft that way than it is by the radio signal transponder method that I talked about, I think last week anyway, I talked about measuring the distance by timing the round-trip travel time for a radio signal. For her purposes, it was not useful to have the picture, it was useful to have a computer printout which gave you the brightness of each one of the little dots that make up the picture. And so she had this, you know, sea of numbers in front of her, and what she was trying to do was mathematically fit a circle through the numbers which would represent the edge of the moon. And in this region, she found for some reason she couldn't do it. So she called for a print of the picture, and this is a better version of that print, made after they knew a little bit more about how to process the computer. This is very heavily computer processed. If you were looking at that with the eye, it would not appear anything like that bright relative to the sunlit surface there. But nevertheless, she saw this. She is universally described by people who know her as unbelievably bright. And although she is not a geologist, instantly she knew what she had, ran down the hall, found a geologist left over from the imaging team. Most of them thought the excitement was over and they'd gone home, you know, and found whatever geologist was left over. And there is a volcanic eruption in which material is being shot out of the surface, out of one of those volcanoes, out of, in fact, no, you haven't seen it yet. Out of one of those volcanoes, being shot out at 1,200 miles an hour, which is a good muzzle velocity for a high-powered rifle if you're not into these things. And it is reaching a height of 200 miles above the surface before falling back. And there is another cloud produced by another volcano erupting at the same moment. There were, in fact, eight simultaneously erupting super volcanoes that happened to be going off on the particular day Voyager 1 happened to fly past Io and take these pictures. And of course, there is no reason to assume there was anything special or unusual about the volcanic activity on that particular day. And they are erupting this material. This is the biggest one. This one is called Plume 1. And that's erupting 100 miles into space, 200 miles into space. A more typical number is 120 miles down to about 80 miles. Nevertheless, these are unbelievably impressive features. And the obvious question is, what is powering that volcanic activity? In fact, what is providing the energy for it in the first place? Before I talk about that, let's tell you a little bit more about the nature of the volcano. Here is a very highly computer processed picture, which is why it looks kind of faked over there at the edge, as though, you know, they cut it out and pasted it together. It was the computer effectively cut it out and pasted it together by switching to a different brightness setting like that over there. This is Plume 2, and that is the one, the two slides earlier, you saw over there. That is an erupting volcano, and in fact, additional computer processing of this picture, which I didn't bother to show you because I've got so much more spectacular ones now, does actually show the material coming out of the plume. And you see, it forms this umbrella-shaped plume, and the material all falls down on the ground at a particular distance away from the volcano at the time this particular picture is shown. Presumably, the volcanoes vary in their strength, they vary in their number, the inactive ones may become active, and it is that process that is constantly burying the material, the surface of Io, under newer material. And that is why, if you painted your name on the surface this week, this year, it will be gone next year. That surface is being buried at a rate of at least a tenth of a millimeter per year. It may be as much as a millimeter per year. And if that doesn't impress you, consider that means a kilometer in just 1,000, I'm sorry, that means a kilometer in just 1 million years. And if you multiply that out by the age of the solar system, if you assume it's been going on for 4.6 billion years, which of course we don't know, the amount of material that was recycled is 10 times as heavy as the entire mass of Io. Now that doesn't mean that the entire mass of Io has been recycled. Probably it's surficial stuff that is recycled over and over and over hundreds of times. How it gets recycled off the bottom is not clear. You know, we can see that it gets buried on the top. We don't know what's going on at the other end of the cycle down at the bottom, but somehow it must be recycled. And what this material is, we think, is sulfur and perhaps sulfur compounds. The white stuff may be solid sulfur dioxide. Because when you look at the volcanoes, this is a visible light picture, and this shows Plume 2, which is about 120 miles high. But if you take an ultraviolet picture of the region around it, I don't have a slide of that, but if anybody wants to come up afterwards and look at my button, it is that picture. And it's been color-coded. so that the material that shines only in ultraviolet is shown as blue, and this material, which in reality, invisible light, is blue, has been shown by a different color, namely yellow. You notice it's bluish. It is not the color of the surface. And so you may say, well, then, you know, how can you say this stuff is varying the surface? See, stay with me. I'll show you. Around that, there is a cloud of gaseous sulfur dioxide. Now, sulfur dioxide is a very interesting material at EO temperature because the temperature at EO straddles the temperature at which sulfur dioxide, under this low pressure, which is essentially a vacuum, would be a gas or would be a solid. It doesn't melt. It goes directly from the gas to the solid at that low pressure, or from the solid to the gas if you heat it up. These volcanoes mean that EO has a very, very thin temporary atmosphere at any given moment, about 1/10,000,000th as dense as that of the Earth. And that was measured directly by the two Voyagers in ultraviolet instruments. They saw this very, very thin atmosphere glowing in the ultraviolet around the volcano. That's in the daytime. As soon as any given region of EO gets to be night, the atmosphere, such as it is, freezes solid and falls on the ground. And once it does so, it is so white and reflective that the temperature there is white stuff, maybe solid sulfur dioxide. The temperature in those regions the next day is low enough that it remains solid for the most part the next day. There's a little bit of vapor pressure, a little bit of gas over, but for the most part it freezes solid and stays there. So what we have here is a cloud of possibly crystals of solid sulfur dioxide or crystals of sulfur mixed with gas. And some of that stuff is going to freeze out and turn white, and the remainder is going to be the red. And so it's not too unexpected that the color of the volcanic eruption is different from the color of the surface. But we don't understand everything about the chemistry and the physics of the eruption, believe me. In any case, the volcanoes appear to be quite blue. Here is a Voyager 2 picture taken from around almost the dark side of Io, and you can see two eruptions up there on the edge, and you can see they're quite intensely blue, Plume 6 and Plume 7. Yeah, what happened was on Voyager 2, let me get to that. Let me come back to that in just a moment. Here is what I think is one of the most incredible pictures from Voyager 1, and I cannot believe this is not one of the pictures that all the magazines have been printing. Everybody always goes, wow, when I show it, you know, and the magazines don't seem to. The only one that I've seen printed was Technology Review in my own article about the Voyager 1 results of the moons of Jupiter. And they printed it because I asked them to, but even they printed it very, very small, and I think lost the impact. It's an absolutely incredible picture. These are apparently lava flows. Now, there's a big argument going on over just what that surface is and what it's made of. One school of thought maintains that, okay, I got to back up. To have a volcanic eruption on the Earth, there has got to be a gas that is driving the material up out of the volcano, okay? That gas, in the case of Earth's volcanoes, is almost always water vapor. There is no water on Io. We know now why. In the first place, Jupiter probably baked most of it out of the material that was to become Io even before the moon formed. But in the second place, water, if there were water inside Io, would have been lost into space billions of years ago if these volcanic eruptions were going on that far back, and if they weren't, it would have been lost into space very soon after they started. Io's gravity is not enough to hold water vapor, even long enough for the water to freeze out. Sulfur dioxide is heavier, so it can do a better job than sulfur dioxide. But Io is totally water. Now, what that means is that there are really very few substances that are volatile, which have relatively low melting points, boiling points rather, that are heavy enough for Io's gravity to hold. And sulfur is the most common of those substances. So what happens is that if you have a planet which has lost its water, its surface, and yet is geologically active, its surface is going to be dominated by sulfur and sulfur compounds, in the same way as the surface of the Earth is dominated by water. And you have seen exactly the same thing on Venus, which is also a waterless planet, but which is hotter, and so has not a surface, but an atmosphere in which the chemistry is dominated by sulfur and its compounds. If you remove the water from a geologically active planet, sulfur takes over by default. Note, in fact, if I may go further, the parallel between Io and Venus on the one hand and Europa and Earth on the other. Europa is a world that is geologically active, less abundant than water cosmically, and only if you remove the water can sulfur dominate. So on Europa, you have water on the outside. On Earth, you have water on the outside. Because the temperature differences, that water is mostly liquid on Earth, it's frozen on Europa. But otherwise, they're a parallel. Europa is what you would get if the Earth's ocean is totally froze, if we ever had a global ice age. Io is like Venus in that it has lost its water and so sulfur dominates, but again, there is a temperature difference. On Io, the temperature is such that the sulfur is as compounds are solid, and on Venus, the temperature is such that they are atmospheric constituents, gases and the liquid droplets that form the clouds, or in some cases, the solid materials that form the clouds. Now, here is a mosaic of four pictures of Io taken from closer in. The color here is less reliable because the spacecraft is moving fast enough and things were happening fast enough that the scientists at this point didn't care if they had all three color pictures, and so they took only two colors. Remember how you synthesize a Voyager color picture out of a blue image, a green and yellow image, and a red image? They took only the blue and the red images here, and in the same way as the Pioneer spacecraft did with all of its images, because it had only blue and red filters, and they did the same thing here as they did with Pioneer, that is, they guessed what the middle constituent would have been in order to fake a color image. And the faking job is not terribly good, because the pictures show detail so much finer than we can see from Earth, unlike the Pioneer pictures of Jupiter, which showed detail not that much finer than we can see from Earth, that you really had no idea how much green to put in. So this is in fact too red, but it's sort of close. Well, two very interesting features there. First of all, Flume 1, the one that Linda Morabito originally discovered. There is a vent of Flume 1, and here is the ring of material that it is depositing, and you will notice that it is able to shoot material farther in some directions than others, right? It so happens that it was able to shoot material farther to the north than to the east or the west. And in the south, it looks as though something was blocking the vent temporarily there, the southern part of the vent, and preventing material from getting as far from the vent. The result was that it produced what Walter Sullivan in the New York Times was the first to point out looks very much like a heifer print. If you know your Greek mythology, Greco-Roman mythology, Jupiter, Io was one of many people that Jupiter made love to. In fact, all of the moons are named for various people that Jupiter made love to. He was into that kind of thing, with the exception of Amalthea, the very closest to Jupiter, who was his nurse in infancy. And just what the significance of that is, I'm not going to try to speculate on. But in any case, Juno, Jupiter's wife, of course, didn't appreciate this kind of thing at all and kept expressing her displeasure in various inventive ways, one of which, in the case of Io, was to turn Io into a heifer. And so, Walter Sullivan pointed out, of course, very much like a heifer print is very appropriate. So that's the Plume 1 structure, the heifer print, as seen by Voyager 1. There is what appears to be, this dark black stuff, appears to be a lake of some kind of hot material. And so does that black thing up there. And this one is Plume, I forget. But in any case, the reason I say that is that the infrared radiometer, the gadget that measures temperatures on Voyager 1, made a temperature measurement of this region, and it turns out that stuff is about 55 degrees Fahrenheit as compared with the rest of Io's surface, which is 230 below zero Fahrenheit. So the black area, you know, there are many black areas on Io, that happens to be about the biggest. If you want to assume that all of these are, quote, lava lakes, go right ahead. The infrared radiometer hasn't the resolution to prove it. But the problem with that term lava lake, which has been widely used, is lava is not 55 degrees Fahrenheit. It is a great deal warmer. And it is not obvious what substance that might be made of. It appears black in visible light, and yet is 55 degrees Fahrenheit, which is too hot for anything at Io's normal surface temperature, and too cold for most of the things you could take pictures being molten. Well, yeah?
Is that called aerobatic?
Okay, you're talking about this thing here? Quite likely. It's caldera is a volcanic collapse crater. Note, by the way, the heifer print, again, it looks like a big depression. It is not. That's painted on the surface. That I can't believe is painted on the surface, but it would get a little bit better focus. It looks more like a caldera, doesn't it? doesn't it? There are certainly features on EO's surface that are undoubtedly collapsed caldera. I mean, it's the one thing the geologists looked at and recognized right away. They look like collapsed calderas, and they have these funny lava flow things radiating out from them. But, as I started to say when I showed you the, well, in fact, yeah, here, let's go back to this picture, there. That's not even as impressive as some of the other stuff. But these look very much like lava flows, and some of them look much better, like much better calderas than that. Now, if that's a lava, if that is formed by molten rock, then the surface, the sulfur is relatively thin. It's sort of painted on the surface. And you have a surface that is dominated by the geology of molten rock, as is the case on the Earth and the Moon. That is one extreme theory in trying to interpret what we're seeing here in Io. The other extreme is, yes, we know this world is made mostly of rock, but if you calculate the amount of sulfur that could have gotten sweated out of that rock over geologic time in the absence of water, if you assume that all of it has in fact made its way to the surface, you ought to have several miles to several tens of miles worth of sulfur and sulfur compounds at the very outside before you get down to the rock. And so there are at least two possibilities for what the propulsive gas is. One is you have molten rock coming up and evaporates sulfur, and the sulfur, the evaporated sulfur, is the propulsive gas. In that case, the material that has erupted from the volcanoes is mostly molten rock, as seems to be suggested by the shape of these lava flows, which looks very much like what you get with certain types of molten rock on Earth. On the other hand, if the thick sulfur crust hypothesis is correct, then what you have is solid sulfur and sodium sulfur sulfur dioxide rather on the outside, liquid, then a layer where there is solid sulfur but liquid sulfur dioxide. So the liquid sulfur dioxide is percolating through the solid sulfur in much the same way as the liquid water percolates through the solid rock fragments that we call our soil here on the Earth. In other words, on Earth we have groundwater. When it rains, the water sinks into the ground, gets down to a certain distance, fills up the spaces between the rocks, stays there. That's why you can dig a well, and eventually you dig down and get water, right? Groundwater. In fact, a river or a lake is simply a place where the groundwater has come to the surface. That the surface has fallen down rapidly enough that the groundwater is out at the surface. On Io, if this second theory is correct, you have ground sulfur dioxide, ground liquid sulfur dioxide. Below that, there would be a layer where both the sulfur and the sulfur dioxide are molten. The picture is, the molten rock comes up from underneath, hits only that layer, spreads out on the bottom of this ocean of molten sulfur, about 5 or 10 miles below the surface. That vaporizes some of the sulfur, which in turn drives out the solid sulfur dioxide above it and spews this material all over the surface, together with some gaseous sulfur dioxide that was produced in the same vaporization. And so the idea is that in one case, the volcanic eruption would be mostly rock, and in the other case, the volcanic eruption would be mostly sulfur, which is a very interesting thought. Of course, I like that one better because it's more dramatic, you know, it's more different from the Earth, but that is not a useful criterion for truth in science, and at this point, all I can do for you is present the two theories, and also note, in fact, that these are two extremes of the spectrum, and that the truth may lie somewhere in between, or that both types of volcanism may exist. Remember how different the polar regions seem to be from the equatorial region, and especially remember those things that look like mesas with eroded edges, as though something had eaten back into them. Well, you could imagine what was eating back into them is these are places where the ground sulfur dioxide is coming out at the edges and eating away the material as it goes at the edge. And so the edge is slowly recessing backward into the interior of the mesa. That kind of process is called sapping. And on Earth, it happens with groundwater at the edges of mesas all the time. It's one of the major processes that produce mesas on the Earth. So you can imagine the fact that both processes are happening on Io, and in any case, it's a really spectacular object. Now the other question, yeah? Where are they ejected? Temperatures? Can't measure. There just is not, the infrared radiometer doesn't have anything like the resolution of the camera. It sees a whole big area on Io. It was a remarkable thing for it to be able to measure the temperature of that, quote, lava lake, and it was only able to do that because that's the biggest of the dark areas on Io. If you want to assume the other dark areas are liquid too, go right ahead. Oh, I don't think anybody has really thought that that far. If it's sulfur, it's probably less hot than if it's rock. But in both cases, you seem to have clouds of solid particles, volcanic ash, rather than lava in the plume. Okay, I mean, that's just from the observations. It looks like clouds of solid particles. And the lava seems to stay down and flow out on the ground as it should. And, of course, that's what you get on volcanoes on Earth. You know, you don't have volcanoes on Earth shooting fountains of lava terribly high up into the air. A few hundred feet, maybe, but not even allowing for the lower gravity on Earth, not anything like the equivalent of 200 miles per EO. Well, the other thing is, what's generating the energy that allows this fantastic volcanic activity to go on in the first place? It cannot be radioactive heating, which is what generates the energy that powers geologic activity, including volcanic activity, on the Earth. What I mean by that is, the rocks contain small amounts of radioactive material. Well, EO is made of rock. It's probably made of rock rather similar to a first approximation of the rock in the inner solar system, so probably contains similar amounts of radioactive material. But the bigger a planet is, the hotter it's going to be on the inside. Okay? If you have a planet, well, let's take the two actual examples, the Earth and the Moon. The Earth is four times the diameter of the Moon. What that means is, the volume of a planet, therefore the amount of rock that it has inside it, therefore the amount of radioactive material it has to generate heat, goes up as the cube of the diameter. If one planet is four times the diameter of the other, its volume is not four times, but four times four times four. Four multiplied by itself three times, or 64 times as great. On the other hand, the heat can be lost into space only from the surface of the planet. And the surface area of a planet by which it can radiate heat into space goes up only as the square of the planet's diameter. In other words, four times four and stop there. So the Earth has 64 times as much radioactive material to generate heat as the Moon, but only 16 times as much surface to lose that heat into space. Can you see how the Earth is going to be hotter inside? This same physics applies in many, many different situations. This is why the mammal population in the Arctic is not dominated by tiny mammals the way it is everywhere else on Earth. You know, everywhere else on Earth, you got the shrews and the voles and those things, and there are many, many more of those than there are the giraffes and the gazelles and the lions. But in the Arctic, you have polar bears, you have snowshoe hares, you get down to lemmings, and that's as small as you get. Reason? These are organisms that are keeping themselves hot from inside, right? They're warm-blooded organisms, and a bigger object that is heating from inside that is losing heat only at the surface traps that heat more efficiently than a smaller one does. So in the Arctic, it is efficient to be a big mammal. Anywhere else on Earth, those considerations don't apply. It's not cold enough. This is also the reason why if you have a pound of ice in the form of a single block, it melts much more rapidly. Here you're talking about heating it up instead of cooling it down. It melts much more rapidly, not much less rapidly, than if you have that same pound of ice in the form of individual cubes, right? Much more surface area in the case of the individual cubes. Okay, so when you consider all of this, the Earth is just barely hot enough inside to be molten in a few places and generate volcanic heat. The Moon is not anything like hot enough inside to do that. Most of the interior of the Moon is solid, very solid, not just semi-solid like the interior of the Earth, the mantle region, and so the Moon is geologically dead as far as volcanism is concerned. There was a time billions of years ago when it was producing volcanic activity, but that may have been because of, for example, short-lived radioactives that are no longer there. Since the Earth is the same size as the Moon and made of rock, we expected it to be equally dead geologically. Obviously, it is not. So where's all that energy coming from? The answer is a very fascinating one, which I don't have time to describe in detail because I've only got 2 minutes left. But basically, there is a gravitational tug of war on Io between Jupiter on one side and the Moon pulling it from the other direction on the other side. And the result of that gravitational tug of war is that Io's orbit is forced to remain non-circular. It's Europa that mostly does this to Io. Io's orbit is non-circular. As a result, it is closer to Jupiter sometimes than others. The difference is not great. The closest to Jupiter it ever gets is only 0.4% greater than its average distance. The farther from Jupiter it ever gets is only 0.4% less than its average distance. But that's Jupiter, and Jupiter is only 250,000 miles away and 318 times as heavy as the Earth. Therefore, it is generating tides inside Io, which are enormous compared to the tides that are generated inside the Earth, for example, by the Moon, and which even those are sufficient to set off the moonquakes that we observe. They are caused by the Earth's tide. As there is the tide that is generated in a solid body, and there is a tide in a solid body, whether you're aware of that or not, there is a tide, but if the orbit were circular, it wouldn't matter. There would simply be a big bulge in the rock, and that would end up very quickly, so it was always facing toward Jupiter, and that would be the end of it. And Io does, in fact, always face the same side toward Jupiter, same as our moon does toward the Earth, and indeed all of the Galilean satellites always face the same side toward Jupiter. I kind of implied that earlier, I didn't really state it explicitly, so let me do so now. But because Io is forced to vary its distance from Jupiter during the course of its orbit, which only takes 2.5 days, every 2.5 days it goes from the farthest to the nearest, and the strength of the tidal force changes as it goes from the farthest to the nearest and then back again. The result is that the height of this tidal bulge, see, the tidal force is strongest when you're nearest to Jupiter. It's least when you're farthest from Jupiter. The result is the height of that tidal bulge flexes up and down every month, every 2.5 days, through a total height of about 800 feet. And that, the heat generated by the friction of that flexing, so great. The heat generated by the friction of that flexing is so great that it is calculated that the entire interior of Io, below a shell that is so thin that we can't even figure out what its thickness would be, the entire interior of Io is molten. This theory is due to three scientists, S.J. Peel, Patrick Reynolds, and somebody other, Catherine. Can't remember. Well, anyway, Peel, Reynolds, and Catherine, who published this theory 3 days before Voyager 1 flew past Io. Their paper appears in the March 2nd issue of Science Magazine, and the flyby was March 5th. They were confident enough, they had realized this last year or thereabouts, that this would happen, and they were confident enough that it would happen, that they were willing to do that, and after these pictures were taken, they were invited to the Voyager imaging room. None of them happened to be on any of the Voyager teams, although several of them worked in NASA and other areas of NASA, and they were described as walking around with ear-to-ear grins. And you see, the same mechanism could operate on Europa as well, but it dissipates only about a tenth as much heat inside Europa during a given time period as inside Io. So it's not too surprising that Europa, although it's geologically active and has a relatively young surface, is not anything like as much so as Io. Okay, let's show you another few pictures very fast. This is the change from Voyager 1 to Voyager 2, in just four months. Voyager 2 did not get close to Io at all. The closest it ever got was about twice the distance of Earth's moon from the Earth. But even so, it was able to get pictures like this. And this is the answer to the question I was asked a while ago. Plume 1, the biggest one, the 200-mile one, the one when the Morabito first discovered, was gone. And so was the Heifer Plume. In its place was an oval of roughly, but not exactly, the same size. Probably that whole oval is new. It's probably not just a matter of the southern part, the indentation is gone and the rest is the same. Probably the whole oval is new, so that apparently before that volcano died, or more likely became temporarily inactive, whatever that block was in the southern part of its vent got blown out, and all of a sudden was able to produce a more symmetrical feature. Otherwise, there were 8 volcanoes at the time of Voyager 1. One of them could not be observed by Voyager 2. Plume 2 was 50% bigger than it had been at the time of Voyager 1, and the others were unchanged, except the Plume 1 had disappeared. So that's the story within 4 months. It's going to be fascinating to see how Io is different several years later when Galileo Orbiter gets to Jupiter. And in fact, the first thing Galileo Orbiter is going to do after making a very close flyby of Jupiter is fly just 1,000 miles above Io. And by now, technology has improved to the point where Galileo Orbiter, this is 1985 we're talking about, December 1985, Galileo Orbiter will not have a television camera. It'll have a Voyager camera as far as the optics are concerned. In fact, it's literally a spare Voyager camera. But the sensing device is not a television screen, a television vidicon. It is a new device called a charge coupled device. And what that means, basically, is that it is something like 100 times as sensitive to light as the Voyager camera. So that means that if you're flying by real fast, you can take an exposure only 1/100th the length of what Voyager would have had to do, which means you won't be smeared even 1,000 miles away from Io, and you won't have to play games with swinging the camera as you take the picture and hope you're swinging at the right rate. So we will see features on Io something of the order of 10 feet across from the Galileo orbiter pictures from the first close encounter in Orbit 1, December 1985. There is a Voyager 2 picture, a Voyager 1 picture, computer processed of one of the volcanic vents, and you can see there's that same strange blue color down there. And it's not really clear what's causing that blue color. But sulfur is very good at producing colors. Sulfur and sulfur compounds are. And just to show you how I haven't told you everything about Io by any means, here is some absolutely weird topography, which I show you just by way of demonstrating weird topography in the South Polar region. Okay, and I wish I could tell you about that, but I'm afraid we are not going to have time, and so we're going to have to stop there. In fact, I've run 5 minutes over as it was. So, thank you very much. Well, in the lecture series, you know, there are 5 lectures, and we picked 5 specific topics, and, you know, several people, you know, just had a question about black holes, and he said, I'm not criticizing the lecture series, but, you know, and obviously he wish I'd talk about black holes. You know, I mean, if I had 40 lectures, I'd talk about 40 subjects. Okay. Yeah, a comet is very, it's made of a head and tail, both of which are very, very thin gas, and those are decomposition products and chemical recombination products of water, methane, and ammonia. Okay. We think that where all that material comes from is the only solid part of the nucleus, the head and tail, the gas, which is extremely low density, far better than so-called vacuum inside a radio tube. But we think where it all comes from, a little bitty object only a mile or so across in a typical case, called the nucleus in the center of the head, and that we think is made of frozen water, methane, and ammonia mixed with dust particles, in other words, rock. And through most of the history of the comet, the nucleus is already exists, so it's utterly unobservable. But comets have extremely non-circular orbits. What I'm doing here is nearly non-circular enough. I could be doing some long loop that would go, you know, maybe literally half a mile out that way, to the side of the sun. And the comet orbit takes it in typically once every 2 million years. How is comet is atypical? It comes out here in 75. In a typical case, every 2 million years, as the nucleus gets inside about the orbit of Mars, or maybe somewhere between Mars and Jupiter, the heat of the sun becomes enough that it needs to evaporate off the outer part of the gaseous nucleus, form it into a gas. The gas expands as a cloud, which is effectively zero gravity, something that's fine. Forms essentially a spherical cloud around the nucleus, which is the head of the comet, and then various forces push it away from the sun to form the tail, which always points away from the sun. There's not material left behind as the comet spins along. In fact, if the comet is moving away from the sun, the tail precedes the head. Okay. So that, in very, very brief terms, is what we think about it.
As far as this material is part of some great solar system, something about that.
Where they came from, you know, certainly, now they're definitely solar system objects. We've never seen one come in an orbit such that it came from beyond the solar system. When I say solar system objects, I mean they orbit around the sun. Far into the orbit can be literally several light years out. You know, I mean, tens of thousands of times farther than the Earth is from the sun. Thousands of times farther than Pluto is out in the orbit. But not all the way up to another star. And we've never seen a comet come here on an interstellar orbit. We seem to believe on the interstellar orbit. They can fly past Jupiter and get speeded up in exactly the same way as the Voyager spacecraft are, and sent on to escape trajectories. It's not hard. They're nearly escape trajectories already. You know, they're going over huge distances turning around and coming back. You just have to speed it up a little tiny bit, and they're never coming back. So we lose comets, but we never seem to gain them. And that's all weird. If other stars are losing comets the same way, how come we never pick one up? And the answer turns out to be statistically, if every star has the same number of comets the sun does and loses the same rate the sun does, it's about 50-50 that we should have picked up one in the few hundred years that we've been observing comets long enough after orbit. So, you know, it's a little strange, but not very strange. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
You're going to have to limit it only by your mic. A number of people put out lithographs of them, but a lot of people, some of them play high quality. So I mean, magazine has a couple of what they call posters, but you have each poster with several pictures, and you can cut it apart and just lithograph it to scale. If you want them, you can get them, but they'll be very expensive. Right now, the next thing you want to do is if you want to look at them, when it's useful, you can look at them in the magazine, or you can find it in the library, you have to get them. And secondly, write to the Public Information Office, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, 4800 Oak Grove Drive, Pasadena, California, 91103, and ask for their set of 9 Voyager 1 lithographs, which has the advantage of being free. And I'm not as high quality as you're trying to learn your own as I can, but they're free. And they have all the, you know, really most spectacular. No, it's not. That's the whole point. There's a commensurability in the theory that the outside room is always in the same position. What happens is that EO goes around exactly once, your open goes around exactly once. So it doesn't even happen. And if it weren't for that commensurability, which is forced by the initial gravity, and you're doing that tonight, you say, once you get into that block, you'll stay. But because of the commensurability, you don't know if it's supposed to be more difficult. Which is very easy. Now, of course, if people were seated in the public, people would be looking at other moons. And for example, Venus, one of the moons is Saturn. The Saturn commensurability on that sort is not the next one by themselves, but the one after that test has a commensurability. The people want commensurability also. And along the old Venus has a certain quote, which I consider more expensive than Venus. And so, graduate students, you don't have to do this, you know that much, but you know everything, ask, I can't remember who was going to ask the Renault test in the field, one of those three authors in theory, the scientific union, I think it's in March, you know, because it's the, it's in March, I don't know. Anyway, you know, because Venus is amazing. And I didn't know it either, so I thought, oh, wow, I got to know that Venus. But the problem is, the rate at which the tidal region is dissipated inside the planet, so inside the moon, goes up at the seventh hour of the radius of the moon, and Venus is a little bitty thing. So the answer is no. So EO is useful and you need to take it. And notice please that in the very first sentence, EO is a proof that geologic activity is only an accidental result of particular conditions in solar system. It ought to be the same as the moon. It would be. Whereas Earth geologic activity, in a sense, is much more normal, less pathological, in that any rock body inside the Earth should be about the same as the Earth inside.
This is not 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 this is not